Welcome to Studio Tulsa and Happy New Year. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. We start off the new year with nutrition. Now that the holidays are over, it's time to think about how to eat right for optimal health. My guest today is a well-known medical doctor and wellness promoter. Michael Roizen became the first chief wellness officer at the famed Cleveland Clinic in 2007. Among other initiatives, he banned smoking on the premises, making it a fireable offense. He also stopped the use of trans fats and fried foods in both the hospital cafeteria and food services for patients. In addition to getting rid of all vending machine drinks containing sugar. Imagine that! Dr. Roizen and his colleagues Dr. Michael Krupain, a preventive medicine specialist, and Jim Perko, executive chef at the Cleveland Clinic, have teamed up on a beautiful new cookbook called the What to Eat When Cookbook. The cookbook is a companion volume to their 2018 book called What to Eat When. The method behind what these authors call the when way include eating only when the sun is out, trying to limit that later in the day eating, and inducing the body to go into ketosis or early starvation overnight to optimize metabolism and take best advantage of the body's circadian rhythms. In the What to Eat When cookbook, the authors pair healthy, mostly plant-based, tested delicious recipes with beautiful photos and serving suggestions. Michael Roizen has co-authored 4 New York Times number one bestsellers and is the creator of Real Age, the concept that your physiologic age may be younger or older than your chronologic age, depending on your health habits. He hosts his own weekly podcast, and among his many awards are an Emmy and the Paul Rogers Best Medical Communicator Award from the National Library of Medicine. Dr. Michael Roizen, Chief Wellness Officer Emeritus at the Cleveland Clinic and co-author of the What to Eat When cookbook, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Michael Roizen, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd like to start just by having you tell us, what is the when way? What is it about eating at certain times that promotes better health and, in fact, as you and your co-authors argue, weight loss?
Well, what the when way is really an understanding of how the circadian rhythm affects the hormones related to metabolism. You already know your circadian rhythm is essentially a way of getting your body ready to do the right things at the right time, such as sleep. So our hormone levels change in response to the sun. And it's not just the hormone melatonin, as all of us know, that helps us sleep, but it changes our metabolism, because over the centuries, we've evolved so that we are more active in the daytime and we're metabolically more active. So when we used to go out and hunt and gather during the daytime and only during the daytime, and that's when we had to have our metabolic energy most efficiently working. And so that's what happens now. We are more insulin resistant as the day goes on. What does that mean? Well, the when way means that you want to eat when the sun is up and more early, less later, not stereotyping food, so you can eat your biggest meal early on and the smallest meal later on, reverse of what we currently do, because that's how we're programmed to be most metabolically active. As to weight loss, I mean, it not only changes the way your genes function, and I can get into that in a second, because we actually get to control the switches on our genes to turn them on or off. But in addition, a calorie is a calorie is a calorie in the test tube. But in your body, a calorie in the morning is like 0.8 calories. A calorie in the evening is like 1.05 calories. So the more you eat early, if you're eating the same amount of food, the less you weigh. And so it's a way of trying to keep weight gain at bay, or if you will, to promote weight loss.
So our culture sort of promotes this, having big dinners and making that evening meal more of the family time because it's after school and after work. But, you're not saying don't eat dinner, but you're saying make that your smallest meal of the day.
That's exactly right. So actually the old English phrase, eat breakfast with your family, lunch with your friends, and give your dinner to your enemies is probably right. used to be eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and dinner like a pauper was the same thing. You want to eat the smallest meal at dinner, and what that does is it gets you to sleep better. It gets you to not be hungry at night if you do it 4 days in a row. And by that fifth day, you'll start having more energy every day. And the reason is simple. That's the way we're eating with our hormones, or what we call it, eating the Wen way.
So one question that I bet you get asked a lot and that I've been wondering is, what does the Wen way have to say about this phenomenon that seems very popular about fasting or intermittent fasting?
So this is a form of intermittent fasting. That is, intermittent fasting, people call it everything from not eating for 2 days in a row to not eating for 8 hours at a time. But in fact, what it is, in truth, the way we get to control our genes and get what we call a gene shift on is by getting ketotic and then getting out of ketosis. If you stay in ketosis, you stay in survival mode, not good for your body. You will live a little longer, but you live much longer if the animal models are correct and the human data and biomarkers are correct. If you fast for 16 to 18 hours a day, get in ketosis, get that shift in genes to survival, and then when you re-eat, you want to re-eat in a pesca-vegetarian way, that is eating fish or chicken, white meat, and mainly vegetables in addition to that, and healthy fats. And when you do that, you then regrow new cells. You recycle your cells when you go into the survival mode, put them into a dormant or hibernating state. And then when you re-eat, if you eat healthily, and that's one of the two things people do wrong with intermittent fasting. And if you then eat healthily, you then regrow younger new cells that have more energy or give you more energy. So the point that people do intermittent fasting wrong in two ways. One we've already talked about, they eat their biggest meal late. And the second is they don't pay enough attention to what they eat. So there are five food felons. And although we have a couple rules, one of which is only eat food that loves you back. That is, food is a relationship. You should love what you eat and it should love you. So it's like a marriage. You wouldn't marry someone who's trying to kill you. You shouldn't eat food that's trying to kill you. Secondly, you want to eat in a way, if you will, that is beneficial. And think about all the things you can have, not about what you can't have. But I'll go over the five foods that people eat a lot of that actually are felonous to them. They cause damage to their insides are simple sugars, added syrup, simple carbohydrates. Those, because they raise your blood sugar too high, and that causes dysfunction in your muscles and then in your liver, which then causes inflammation in you. And the fourth and fifth thing are trans fat. That's mainly fried food. And five is foods with saturated fat, not because of the saturated fat, but because of the carnitine, lecithin, and choline, the amino acids that come with it that change the bacteria in the vast majority of us, over 80% of us, to produce inflammatory proteins, trimethylamine, that causes us to have increased heart disease, increased cancer, and increased brain dysfunction. So what's happened is we are eating both at the wrong time and the wrong food when we do intermittent fasting wrong. But you can easily switch it to do it right and get the benefits of what we call recycling your old cells into younger, new, vibrant cells and you getting more energy from it.
I wanted to ask you about your role as chief wellness officer. You're famous in some circles for when you, first of all, you were the very first, if I understand correctly, chief wellness officer at the very well-known Cleveland Clinic. And you did some very interesting things. I believe when you came in back in 2007 or so, or pretty quickly when you started, you banned tobacco all over the campus, which doesn't sound that earth-shattering now, but you took it to the extent that nobody was going to be hired if they were a smoker. And I'm wondering what happened with that, if that was it you were able to enforce
we've gone
that.
We've gone from about 16% of our employees and 21% of our dependents using tobacco to now it's under 2% of both. And what happened initially, and just so people know that you know this, but the downtown Cleveland Clinic is 16, it's now 18 blocks by 5 blocks, was 16 blocks by 5 blocks in that era. And we got permission from the city to ban smoking within that area. After all, medical centers shouldn't have smoking. My CEO at the time, I reported to the chief wellness officer, reported to the CEO, who was Toby Cosgrove, a heart surgeon who had seen heart and lung, had seen what lungs look like and the hazards of this, so he was willing to stick by it and push it. And in fact, we gave our employees, we didn't want them smoking on campus or any or on that 16 by 5 block area, as well as our visitors, et cetera. We escorted the visitors to the tobacco treatment center, the police did. And the police enforced it. The first time an employee broke the problem, they got a warning, and the second time they were fired. There were a couple of high-profile surgeons, very prolific surgeons, who refused to quit. They said they were going to smoke in their office, and Toby just fired them.
Wow.
And so when he showed that this pertained to anyone, there were no special exceptions to it, we really did get an enormous buy-in. It did cause a couple of interesting things. My office got moved to a place where it was hard to shoot me with a rifle or a gun in any way, because we got a couple of we got 3 death threats that the FBI regarded as serious. So they moved my office to a place where the there's a lot of protective glass, and it's very hard to shoot me. So that was one of the, and I'll tell you about the second thing. When the employees, when they realized we were serious, did join in and help us. I mean, as we say, it's down below 2%. You can smoke, obviously, at your home. We can't control that. But we also stopped hiring smokers. And so you get tested just like you get drug tested before you're hired. And if there's tobacco and we would hire you, you get sent to, you get offered a tobacco cessation program for free. We actually had about 1,700 people try and get hired here just so they could get the free tobacco cessation program. But anyway, we have helped. We offered it free, actually, to everybody in Cuyahoga County, the county we live in. And we got 17,000 people in the county off tobacco as well.
That is absolutely incredible.
And so, and then we did the same thing with sugared drinks. You can't buy a sugar drink or sugar on campus anyplace. Doesn't mean you can't bring in a Coca-Cola, but we don't want you to, I mean, the data were clear enough, so we switched all the vending machines, et cetera. The vending machine, Pepsi-Cola called Toby, in fact, the CEO, and said, you're going to lose $600,000 in educational allotment we give to you for this. And Toby said it would be the best $600,000 we lost, but that people will buy water and that Pepsi has a lot of water products, et cetera. And in fact, sales went down for about 2 months by about 60%. Vent from our soda vending machines, and came back up over a period of another 4 months. So by 6 months, we were selling just as much stuff out of the vending machines as we were beforehand. We also changed all the vending machines. But just so you know, when we did that, I got the 3 death threats from different post offices that the FBI said were real, but when we took sugared beverages out, I got 75 death threats, but those all came from email.
Wow.
So we knew who sent them, so to speak, and knew they weren't serious. But anyway, so it is a journey. We, as you probably know, the Cleveland Clinic now offers no food with processed meats in it, and no food with sugar in it, and no non-100% whole grain products to any of our patients, visitors, et cetera, on campus. We're a pretty big institution, as you know. We have, I think we have 67,000 employees, so it's not a small institution. We didn't make a small change. We tried to influence, and now, as you said, that was in 2006 that we not only banned smoking, but said you couldn't, that our employees couldn't smoke in the 16-by-5 block area. And now it isn't thought of as very innovative, but we keep pushing the envelope and doing things.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. Michael Roizen, who is Chief Wellness Officer Emeritus at the Cleveland Clinic, also co-author of the What to Eat When cookbook, which is a newly released companion volume to his best-selling book, What to Eat When, that he co-authored along with Dr. Michael Krupain. And Michael Roizen, I got this cookbook. I have to say it's beautifully presented. The pictures are gorgeous. My family and I are plant-based, so but many of the recipes did appeal to us. And I have to say the chapter that you have on sweets and desserts was pleasantly surprising. We made it's like the nut and chocolate cookies. They're absolutely phenomenal.
The no-bake cookie and apricot nut bars is one of them, and the other is a chocolate nut cookie.
That's it, the chocolate nut
and
cookie.
And there's the Wenway chocolate mousse, which is one of my favorites to make because it's one, it's so delicious, but it is so easy to make. So we have all of those. In addition, if you want to know the one, if you go to page, if you got it in front of you, go to page 252 to 253, the whole grain and dark chocolate What to Eat When bars. It look exactly like that and taste even better, if you can believe it. So there are a lot of potential chocolate desserts in there. And I've got to tell you, one of my favorite breakfast ones is the What to Eat When Berry Crisp.
Well, yeah, I think one of the big take-homes is this is a method of when you eat and thinking about some of the science behind it. But they're really, other than eating wisely and, as you said, emphasizing plants and fruits and vegetables over other foods, there aren't really limits per se. I mean, you're having people eat what they want essentially, but just doing it, you know, when the sun is shining. I think that's kind of the major innovation here.
Yes, and it is eating food that really does taste great and is absolutely healthy. So the point is, you can eat something with chocolate without added sugar that, in fact, you're surprised at how good it is. So the chocolate mousse, for example, is as good as you can take any chocolate mousse but no eggs and no cream, and it's really done incredibly well. So it is very possible to do that.
Yeah, we're definitely going to try that. The recipe I was referring to was the chocolate chunk and nut chewies, which are amazing because they have no flour and they have no sugar and, of course, no eggs, as you mentioned. But the real thing that was a revelation to us was this idea of raisin reduction. And I just have to say, this is so easy. You take some raisins, like a cup of raisins, you put a cup of water in, and you just simmer them for like 15 minutes or something, and then you food process them. And then you have this beautiful sweetener that's natural because it's raisins. And we put it on oatmeal. We put it on lots of other things in addition to using it for this recipe. And it's absolutely delightful. I never had even heard of that, raisin reduction. We're not chefs
either. Yeah, and so raisins, because they come with a lot of fiber, not grapes. Grapes, when you have them, because of the fluid in them, you will absorb that, raise your blood sugar fairly quickly and to a high level. But raisins, because they are somehow the property of the sugar and the fiber changes, you raise your blood sugar much less quickly. And so you can keep it down. And in fact, one of the things that I've learned is since I've been avoiding sugar for so many years that I actually don't have the raisin reduction in most of the recipes. We made that so that the tasters, we had a bunch of tasters, loved it, who weren't avoiding sugar all the years. But in fact, for example, in that recipe, I don't add the, I just do it without the raisin reduction. And there's a golden milk one as well that I do without, and a pumpkin. This is one of Jim Perko's favorites. He's the, if you will, Papa in this. It's Papa's Pumpkin Pilot. I have to cut out the raisin reduction, and it's the one recipe we have syrup in, maple syrup. I have to cut out both of those, or else it's way too sweet for me.
Yeah, so, see, that's a good example of how you've adapted your taste buds. You don't, you know, like, well, unlike most Americans, anything that's of usual process sweetness is just overpowering and kind of, frankly, disgusting.
That's exactly right.
Dr. Roizen, I want to ask you, maybe the thing that you're most well known for is this concept called real age. And I was wondering, for those of our listeners that don't know you or know of your work, I was wondering if you could just kind of neatly encapsulate what real age is and maybe how you came up with that.
So your real age is the actual age of your body as opposed to your calendar age. And there are 157 choices women can make, 156 men can make, that change their rate of aging. And so women at age 75 can be about 31 years younger physiologically than their calendar age. What that means is have the risk of dying and disability of someone who's 44. Men about 29 years younger. So men can have the physiology, the risk of dying, disability, the risk of erectile dysfunction, the full range of risk of heart attacks, the risk of memory loss of someone who's 46, much lower than that of a 75-year-old by doing these things. But it really didn't start this way. It started as a way of motivating patients to change their risk of surgical operations. So early on in my career, I was asked to chair cardiovascular anesthesia. I'm both an internist and an anesthesiologist, and I wanted to run an ICU. And I started by running, in that era, the step-down ICU, which was for vascular patients at the University of California, San Francisco. I was at UC San Francisco. And so I was running that, and the surgeons asked me literally 1 year out of fellowship, unusual, to if I would run cardiovascular anesthesia. And our department asked me at the same time, that is anesthesia and intensive care. And so I said, what did they want? And they said, we want to lower our risk, the complication rates of patients undergoing major cardiovascular procedures. So at that time, California was unique, and I was very lucky to find this out. They kept records of all of the operations, cardiac operations, and outcomes of patients in the demographics. And it turned out that the major association, the major risk for patients was their age, much more so than their kidney function or their liver function or their brain function or even their heart function, even though their heart was being operated upon. So I started to try and study, how do we get to change the patient's rate of aging? Now it's pretty common that it is physical activity before and after the operation, it is stress management, it is controlling blood pressure. Anyway, I was motivating one patient who wasn't taking his blood pressure pills, a guy named Martin. And I said, Martin, you're not taking your blood pressure. This is in pre-op clinic. I said, you're not taking your blood pressure pills, are you? And your blood pressure is, I think it's 156 over 95. And I said, that makes you the equivalent of 12 years older. You're really not 49, which was his calendar age at the time. You're closer to 61 in terms of your risk of dying and disability after an operation, after this operation. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, because your blood pressure is elevated, your arteries are older, your liver functions older. That means you get more inflammation in your body. That means you function with the energy level, with the ability to recover of someone who's really 61, not someone who's 49. And so he said he was a physics major in college. He was a successful businessman, as I subsequently found out. And he said, show me the data. And I showed him the data. And he said, how many other things can you do that for? And I said, I don't know, probably the Framingham 12. We don't have we haven't done the full data at the time. That was 1985 or 84. And he said, how much will it cost me to find out how many things you can do that for? And so I said, well, I know the guy who runs the epidemiology department at Stanford, and I know the person who runs the Carter Center at the CDC, which does risks. And I said, I know another guy who's interested in this at the University of Chicago. I had just gotten to the University of Chicago at that time. And I said, now I need an economic statistician, because this is just the same type of work that economists do for the net present value of investments. This is the net present value of your health changes. And I said, so let's get them all, two trips to Chicago, some research associate time. So I said, $25,000. And to my surprise, he reached into his breast pocket, pulled out his checkbook, wrote a check for $25,000 and said, get started. I want the results in 10 weeks.
Wow.
So in 10 weeks, actually it was about 12 weeks, we gave him the notion that you could probably do this. There probably was enough data to have a scientific assessment of what each thing does to your rate of aging in about 50 things. And he said, well, where's that data? And we said, well, it's much more expensive because you got to do what we call analysis of covariance and et cetera on each of these things. So, for example, if you walk, you not only get the benefits of physical activity for your muscle, but you lower your blood pressure, you lower your risk of a bone fracture, you decrease your risk of dementia and of cancer, and all those things have to be calculated separately because you're also lowering when you walk, you lower your blood pressure, and those are two separate calculations. And so he said, how much will that cost? And he said, $1 million, $1.5 million. And so he reached into his breast pocket again, pulled out his checkbook, wrote a check for $50,000 and said, get started, I'll help you raise the rest of the money. And that's how Real Age was born.
Well, great work. The name of the book we're talking about here today is the What to Eat When Cookbook, brand new book out by one of its co-authors, Dr. Michael Roizen, who is Chief Wellness Officer Emeritus at the Cleveland Clinic. Mike Roizen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's a privilege.
Dr. Mike Roizen is Chief Wellness Officer Emeritus at the Cleveland Clinic and co-author of the new book, The What to Eat When Cookbook. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Next week on the program, we'll continue talking about nutrition. We'll interview author Gary Taubes about his new book, The Case for Keto, Rethinking Weight Control and the Science and Practice of Low-Carb, High-Fat Eating. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.